Penguin Random House Canada presents The Peace, A Warrior's Journey. Written by Romeo Dallaire, with Jessica Humphreys, and read by Paul Gross.
Pour Marie, qui m'a guidé comme Béatrice l'a fait pour Dante.
Introduction. Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself within a forest dark. Dante, Inferno, Canto 1. Having lived through biblical horror and then a lifetime since tried to fathom it, I share my path here in hopes that it may help others whose absolute desire is lasting peace, including those, such as myself, who were trained in war. In April 1994, the lush and beautiful country of Rwanda, where I had been tasked with the United Nations mission to assist in the implementation of a peace accord where peace did not exist, descended into genocide. 800,000 dead in 100 days, millions mutilated, orphaned, and displaced. Cycles of generational trauma set in motion. All a full half century after the Holocaust, despite the world's relentless refrain, never again. Rwanda and its people, and my peacekeeping mission, were abandoned to the killing. When I begged for help, I was reminded that there was no oil in Rwanda, no diamonds, nothing else of strategic importance. There were only human beings, black lives that didn't matter. For decades after the mass slaughter ended, I was haunted by the spirits of the dead, the cries of the abandoned, the anguish of survivors, and the guilt of being powerless to stop the slaughter. And I struggled to find answers to impossible questions. How? Why? What if? If I had not lived the experience of Rwanda, I would have carried on serving in the Canadian Armed Forces, eventually retiring as a general with 3 stars, a fishing rod, and a plaque. I would have gone on to a civilian job and volunteer work, like so many of my colleagues trained in the Cold War era did. I suppose I could have forced myself along that predictable path when I got back from Rwanda. My family and my commanders clearly hoped I would get back to normal. But the genocide had completely shifted my perspective on who I was and what I stood for. It shocked me into a profound realization of the precious frailty of life and a deep consciousness of my relationship with the whole of humanity. In other words, I found my soul. I came home injured, yes, and went on to suffer post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and an even deeper moral injury of a scale and duration that several times brought me to the brink of suicide. But I was also imbued with a vision of our shared humanity and my own responsibility to it. This vision drove me to recognize that I had been going in the wrong direction, and not only me, but the military, the whole system. Rather than continuing to focus on winning wars, we needed to set our minds on shaping peace. The genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda prompted a generation of scholars, politicians, soldiers, lawyers, and humanitarians to seek new ways to prevent another such failure of humanity. We set up tribunals, crafted doctrine, and produced countless reports on how to protect civilians from massive abuse, including genocide. But these efforts have not brought the peace we sought. Instead, they've served as temporary and often superficial truces, briefly silencing guns and stabilizing frictions without resolving their fundamental causes. Over the past 30 years, the genocide has been the driving force behind my relentless advocacy work on the prevention of mass atrocities and the protection of civilians. My efforts to end the use of children in armed conflict and the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and to help lift the taboos around operational stress injuries like the ones I suffered.
I'd also been given the mandate to conduct a full reform of the officer corps, so that going forward no Canadian officer tasked with leading a UN peace mission would be as unprepared as I was for what they would encounter. I engaged in endless initiatives. The will to intervene guidance aimed at implementing the new responsibility to protect R2P doctrine, founding the Dallaire Institute for Children, Peace and Security, which drafted the Vancouver Principles on Peacekeeping and the Prevention of the Recruitment and Use of Child Soldiers, and partnering with the United Nations, the Government of Canada, Kofi Annan's Genocide Prevention Advisory Board, Wounded Warriors Canada, the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies, MIGS, the Harvard Kennedy School, the Pugwash Conferences, and the International Principles for Peace, P4P Commission, to provide a covenant for lasting peace. My engagement in these efforts was directly linked to my guilt over witnessing mass murder on an unimaginable scale without being able to stop it. My inner torment during those decades after the genocide is well documented. Coming from a military family and a career spent preparing for war, I worked with punishing zeal, lecturing, advising, writing, berating, all with the aim of uncovering a new understanding of peace. Long after the international community had put the incredible atrocities into the past, content to move on to the next crisis, I continued to dedicate my days and nights to these efforts. Yet over and over, as various doctrines and initiatives were launched and fell short, I saw that we had still not cracked the code. Though humanity kept trying to get far enough ahead of catastrophes to prevent them, we kept failing. Today, polarization, proxy wars, hybrid warfare that combines conventional tactics with online propaganda, geopolitical tensions, large-scale violations of human rights, and the erosion of representative government all make peace building increasingly complex. The recent impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, climate change, and war on supply chains and food and energy prices highlights the interconnectedness and interdependence of a globalized world. Overall, we seem to be barely managing crises as they pop up, rather than acting to prevent such massive suffering. I still hope to be part of the wave of thought and activism that changes that. I received my military training in the Cold War. At that time, peace was viewed as a détente between the communist East and the capitalist West, reinforced by the mutually assured destruction of a balance of nuclear weapons between us. Like many others, I saw the end of the Cold War in 1989 as the opportunity to judiciously draw down armies and defense spending and focus on humanitarian efforts. And Europe, despite its long history of antagonism among nationals, did make strides in establishing and maintaining peace based on economic prosperity, human rights, and a union of effort. At the same time, however, three major powers, China, Russia, and the United States, used the end of the Cold War to increase their military might. Russia has since become a giant rogue state, invading Ukraine in 2022 and attempting to gather allies wherever U.S. influence has ebbed, namely in Syria, the Middle East, and parts of Africa. China's true ambitions are still murky, but clearly reach beyond its current borders. Despite some isolationist moments, the U.S. sees itself as the single entity that guarantees the security of the entire world, deploying its power throughout the globe. In stark contrast to the European doves, American hawks still see the exercise of power as the only way to peace. So, decades after the Berlin Wall fell, we have stumbled back into a power-based world of alliances, where truces are more fragile now than they have been in decades. History continues to repeat ad nauseam. Peacekeepers by the tens of thousands are patrolling, observing, and sporadically intervening in complex conflict zones, armed with limited resources and, too often, let down by outdated and superficial training, ambiguous mandates,
and inadequate leadership. Darfur, Mali, Congo.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?